should we just proceed?
Let's proceed. Let's be daring and proceed.
Hey, you guys, this is the Mean Magazine podcast, and I'm your host, Kristen Filipkowski. The Mean podcast is where I talk to creative, curious, and ambitious women of all ages who are brave enough to be honest on social media and beyond. They're not afraid to show their flaws, and they're finding success and joy while they're at it. Hey, everyone. I hope you're all safe and healthy. It's week 5 of California's shelter-in-place directive, so we're all still homeschooling and hunkering down, but my family remains healthy, so I'm grateful for that. Our son is trying to get a job at an Amazon warehouse, so that's causing me some anxiety, but I'm holding out hope that the process of getting him in their employment system continues to be super glitchy. And then I feel guilty about that because he really wants to earn money. It's just a lot of emotions. I'm guessing you guys can all relate. For anyone else feeling all the feelings right now, I have a really special podcast for you today with author Jennifer Loudon, whose most recent book entitled Why Bother will be published on April 21st. Loudon was one of the first self-care authors way back in the day when she published her first book in 1992. This is her 8th book, and I found it to be not only extremely engaging and useful, but it's also an incredibly brave book for many reasons. For one, it's very personal. She tells the story of her own struggle with depression and wondering why she should bother. She also tells the love story between her and her current husband, which almost did not come to fruition. She also shares the story of her experience on Oprah, which honestly made me very intimidated to interview her, but the story that she tells about that experience had me so on edge that I almost could not take it. And to top it all off, Loudon is self-publishing a book at a time when she can't do all of the things one would normally do to promote a book, like doing a book tour and hosting events. So it's a tough time to be releasing a book, but like I said, I really enjoyed this book. Loudon's writing about how to feel truly satisfied with life really resonated with me. I actually have already put into use many of the suggestions that I took from the book. And if you've ever had that why bother feeling, that feeling like you're too old, not smart enough, not good enough, what's the point? This is a must read. Even if you haven't had precisely that feeling, the book is really helpful for anyone who wants to connect with their desire and make moves towards getting what you desire. So anyway, without further ado, on to the show, and I really hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm so excited to have today on the podcast Jennifer Loudon. Am I saying your name correctly?
Perfectly.
Okay, good. She is the author of the book Why Bother, which will be published, is it May 5th?
We've actually moved it up, so it's April 21st.
Oh, okay. That's exciting. And I just read it and I enjoyed it so much. I really, really got a lot out of it. And I'm just really excited to interview you after having read it.
Yay.
Yeah. And just to introduce you a little bit more, you're sort of a self-care OG. You're like, you've been doing this. I don't know how you feel about the term self-care. It's kind of, I mean, it's, you've been in the business for a long time.
Yeah, I'm old. Yes.
Me too. I am right there with you. So I don't, and we're not old. Let's say we're not old, but okay. We're seasoned or something like that.
Love it.
But you wrote your first book in 2005, correct?
No, 1992.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
So even longer than I realized you've been doing this. And so, and you've written how many books?
I know, I lose track, but I think it's like 8.
Wow. That's really amazing and impressive. And so we'll talk more about like your history and writing these books and all of that. But sort of right now, it seems like we have to talk about what is just going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And
that is the coronavirus pandemic is happening and we're all sheltering in place, unfortunately. And are you in Colorado?
I am. I'm in Boulder County. We sheltered in place about 3.5 weeks ago.
Okay. Yeah, same here. I'm in Pacifica, California, Northern California. And yeah, it's such a crazy time. It must be a little bit of a frightening time to be releasing a book. I don't know if you had planned on like doing a book tour and stuff like that, but plans are probably changing, I'm guessing. How is that going for you?
Honestly, about 2 weeks ago, I was pretty devastated. This book is really the fruition of my life's work. Mm-hmm. And it took me 11 years functionally to write it. I didn't try to write this book for 11 years, but I've been trying to write my next book for 11 years. And I am functionally also self-publishing this book. I have a publisher who acts and looks like and talks and quacks just like a publisher, as all my other books were traditionally published by Big Five publishers, but I'm actually footing the bill. And mm-hmm. So the level of commitment, time, money, it's bigger than any of my other books by far. And we've been planning all kinds of fun things to launch the book and get the word out. And none of them are working.
Oh my gosh, that must be very frustrating.
You know, I'm feeling I'm riding a roller coaster quite a bit, but I'm also finding a tremendous amount of letting go because there's only so much I can do. And so I'm finding that I'm much more okay than I was a couple weeks ago. I was so crushed and I was so disappointed and so despairing. And I got fairly dramatic around the house about it. and I'm still, I cried this morning, but then I'm just in this kind of peaceful place of making my best efforts every day. If I have new ideas about how to get the word out, I take action on them. And then I go, go for a run, take a shower, crawl in bed and read.
Thank goodness you have your running. It was very interesting for me to read about your evolution into becoming a runner sort of later in life than most people do start doing things like that. But also, it seems like the question of why bother is so important right now. It seems like so many people are asking that question. Just as an example, I have so many friends who have retail stores, who have like built these businesses, these loyal followings, like have become, known entities in their neighborhoods and their communities. And it's all just completely fallen apart. So for someone who like has a dream, who may have always dreamed of having like a storefront or opening a business or whatever they want to do, and then you look at the possibility that everything could just fall through the floor, it seems like the question of why bother or how to answer that is so important right now.
I think it will become important for those of us who find that we can't build things back. But right now, I think in the moment, because my business for the first time in many, many years is, we just did number projections, my assistant and I, and we're like, well, that might happen, but it might not. Well, that might happen and it might not. So I'm right there with your friends and everybody else who listening who's in that place. And I think that if there's any opportunity here, and there might not be except for survival, it is an opportunity to listen deeply to what we might want in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We have this about a year ago. We live in this kind of mixed use, kind of new urbanism neighborhood that looks out on, the mountains and cornfields, but surrounded by really blank suburbia. But it's this really cool, vibrant neighborhood. And we had this new bakery go in about a year ago, and they have just knocked it out of the park, which is hard to do in our retail space in our little funny downtown. And they have just been doing fantastic. And then this happens. And we are all working so hard to support them. But what's even more amazing is how they are recreating themselves and finding ways to like do take and bake to take home so people can afford to get takeout, and cutting back on hours, but then managed to get enough business going to bring people back in. And so I think for someone like me, who's kind of like, oh my God, some days I'm so frozen and godsmacked by all of this, I don't even know what to do. I'm trying to use the time to find out what I might want to do in my work next. I have enough money in the bank for the next few months. I've applied for the PPP loan stuff. So I'm not in that totally panic mode, but I might become someone depending on what happens. So I think there's an opportunity right here. If we have it, if you can take it, if you can calm down enough, if you're not getting evicted, right? To be like, what is calling to me? What might it look like? I mean, I'm amazed by this baking couple. They're a married couple and what they're doing to recreate. I mean, and how fast they're doing it. I can't do it that fast.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I've seen a lot of small businesses doing that. And a lot of them are not even, you know, really looking out for themselves, at least not alone. They're, you know, I have a lot of people who have written about who run, who are designers, who make clothing or, and they're like small brands, but they're like making masks possibly without payment. And they're, you know, they're just kind of, people are just kind of hitting the ground running, seeing what they can do to help, you know, and it's just going to be, I guess the why bother will come after we can.
I do think it will come later in the sort of what I call the grubby bummer question, but it might not. I mean, if you have the opportunity, anybody listening, to reflect, to get quiet, to ask yourself, what do I really want? What might look different? What do I want to change? That could be an opportunity of this time. What I'm worried about is people having to scramble so hard and work so hard, or putting so much pressure on themselves to be uber productive and creative that they come out of this time so burned out. And that, I think, would really be a shame.
That is a scary sort of thing to think about, because it seems like we're just all going to want to exhale and just take a nap ever.
Right. So could we do some of that now, if possible? That's kind of what I'm thinking for myself.
Yeah.
And therefore, some of the ideas in the book are really useful for that.
Yeah. So, yeah, this book, I confess I have not read your previous books, but just sort of browsing your previous books, this one seems a little bit different to me based on, I don't know, even just based on the cover, very different, but it also kind of feels different just looking at the summaries. And with the thing, and I don't know if I'm correct, but I'm wondering if part of what's different about this book is that you talk a lot about being like learning to be okay with being uncomfortable. And the previous books, you talked a lot about comfort, you know, you're learning how to comfort yourself, self-care, et cetera. And this one, you talk a lot about like, it's going to be uncomfortable sometimes. And if you can learn how to be okay with that, you can really learn a lot.
Well, honestly, the Woman's Comfort Book, which was my first book that then became a series, the Couple's Comfort Book, et cetera. That title came to me, and that story is in the Why Bother book. That title came to me in a moment, probably the first moment of true surrender in my life. And what I figured out pretty fast writing that book, but certainly when I began to lead workshops and give keynotes afterwards, is that it wasn't comfort the way we usually think about it. I mean, it was comfort that helped you to be stronger, to be more vibrant, to be more yourself. It's really, truly, that whole message of all those books had a deep feminist core to them. But again, since the first book was published in 1992, in a lot of ways, not on purpose, but I soft-coded it. I think, and truly, I was a lot younger. You know, I don't think I was 30 when my first book was published. And so I think that being able to be comfortable in the discomfort was in those books, but with aging and with all the shit that has happened to me, I definitely learned that to bring that to the forefront in a way. But I think that's one of the things that self-care movement as it is now, this multi-billion dollar industry, which certainly didn't exist when I started, I think it's often become a sort of a way to baffle yourself from life, right? Kind of wrap yourself in cotton wool. And I never wanted that or wanted to participate in that.
Okay. Got it. So you'd mentioned that when you came up with the title of the comfort book, and I'm not sure if I remember exactly when you described that, but there was a moment that really stayed with me when you were younger and you were writing a screenplay. I don't know if it was your first screenplay, but you were like not feeling it. And you had this inner voice that was saying you really needed to take a break from writing.
Yeah, that's exactly when the title came to me.
Yeah. And this felt like very monumental, and you were very, it was like really shaking you at your core sort of. And so you called a friend and you sort of felt like you were like dropping this big news on her, like, oh my God, I'm going to stop writing. And she was like, oh, okay, whatever. And then she like proceeded to talk about like her writing and what she was doing. And it was like no big deal to her whatsoever. And I wondered, like, was it because you did not get, like, why at that moment did that concept come to you? Was it because you didn't get any kind of comfort from your friends? So you that you couldn't rely externally, you know, to get comfort from someone, or was it something else?
I don't know. I mean, that's a great idea. I don't know why I hung up from that conversation and had this title pop into my head that really started my whole career. I don't know. I've always thought that it was the moment in which I stopped making deals with myself that if I could just do X, which in this case X was write a screenplay and sell it for a lot of money, I would finally be okay. And in some ways, it's very interesting. I didn't think about this until now, but in some ways, the timing of the pandemic and releasing the book into who knows what's going to happen, it has a similar feeling to it. It has a similar, just really sweet, terrifying, but at the same time, totally reassuring letting go. You know, just letting go, like, okay, well, I thought to email those people today. I made that pitch. I did that podcast interview. I don't know what else to do. Okay, we're letting go. And so there's a you reminded me, you made me see this. I feel a familiarity in it. It's quite comforting. So thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah. And it's nice that you can, it feels like the way you describe it, that you've learned a lot of your own lessons a little bit.
That is so, so doggone true. Oh my God. And I will continue to learn them. I am such a slow learner.
Same. But you described in the book that, you know, you were in the, all these years you've been in the business of helping women sort of be kind to themselves. And, but you weren't doing it for yourself. Like you sort of didn't practice what you preached in a way, maybe?
No, yeah. No, I didn't. I didn't, you know, and I think that's common for people who are in the so-called helping professions. But what I didn't get until I went through that really long, dark time that I write about in part of the book is that I didn't get the cost. I think it's so easy to talk about these things in sound bites or they become cliches. But when we are cruel to ourselves, when we're constantly raising the bar on ourselves, when we never allow ourselves a sense of rest and satisfaction in being who we are, it undermines every single aspect of our life. And it is the single biggest cause of feeling, why bother? What's the point? Who cares? But I didn't get it, right? I didn't get it. To get it is so huge because you really can't forget it once you get it. You can forget it for a little while. You can be hard on yourself for a little while, but then it just kind of starts that old feeling of just disliking yourself and being dissatisfied. And for me, sort of, oh, I don't know, like I'm making a little sour face if you can see me. You cotton on to it. And you're like, I can't, oh no, I'm not going there. I'm not going to do that to myself. Yeah. I'm not going to do that to myself anymore. I refuse.
I love that. You say in the book that you don't have to get over anything to get on with your life. And I read that. I felt very freeing to me. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, sort of where that idea comes from and how it has played out for you, if that's something significant for you, or just in general, how it can play out.
It's tremendously, it's right there with what we were just talking about in terms of a life lesson for me. It is the first way, the first requirement of bothering again is, what do we have to leave behind? What do we have to stop identifying with? What do we have to stop fondling as an old belief or story about ourselves or someone else? Without the ability to sort of hit refresh in how we see ourselves and others and possibilities, even when we've gone through terrible grief and loss, it's really difficult to encounter life again. It's really difficult to have possibilities or enjoy your day.
Yeah. And then you also talk a lot about self-trust, which I thought was really, really interesting. And this one thing that you said, I felt like we had a lot in common at that moment. You said, You said that you have an ancient imprint of shame around being stupid.
I do.
So do I.
Hey, too stupid. We'll have to do our own podcast. Too stupid, girls.
Maybe two stupids equals one smart. I don't know.
Oh, don't get ahead of yourself.
But I loved what you said about, you said, when I can trust myself in these moments, say what I feel while also trusting my basic goodness, everything softens. And I was like, whoa, like I actually put that into use like that day with my husband. I was like, oh my gosh, like maybe I don't have to act like a total ice queen to him right now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, you know what I've been noticing? I taught this the other day. I was teaching like a one day online virtual retreat for all kinds of writers. And I asked them to call on all the kindness and love and care they're feeling for the people in their life, for the healthcare workers on the front line, for the people who are working at the grocery store. I mean, all the tenderness. Like, I don't know about you, but I'm breaking into tears regularly.
Oh, yeah.
And you're feeling so much like, I mean, I also get incredibly angry and rageful, but we'll talk about a different time. So, but that tenderness, right? And just like the tenderness when someone clears the path so that we stay 6 feet away from each other on the bike path or, you know, all of that. And I said, just put your attention there. That's your essential goodness. That's your true nature. It's not that our pettiness and our jealousy and all those other things aren't real too, but the way our brains are structured, we privilege those. We believe they're bigger and more real than our tender hearts, than this boundless kindness that we really do show for others so many times a day. And so this, I feel like this is such an opportunity to feel that and put our attention there more. And that, I think, can really increase that sense of I can trust myself. Not to be perfect, not to make the right decisions, you know, around your business or your family or whatever's going on, but around the fact that you really do mean well. You really are a kind person. You really are loving, and that we can feed that right now.
Yeah. When I was, that just reminded me of my high school English class. My teacher, the theme of the whole year was the question was, is the basic nature of man good or evil?
Mm.
And so we read like The Heart of Darkness and like, you know, classic novels. And I was always like, well, when is she going to tell us the answer?
Big reveal.
Like she never really did, but you know, obviously she wanted us to answer it for ourselves, but you know, I like to be an optimist and think that it's, that we're good, that we're all good. But I wonder why, have you done any research into why do our brains always go to the more negative emotions?
Sure. Yeah. It's the negativity bias. So we think that the reason it happened, or not we, but people who research this, think the reason that we developed a capacity to go there more quickly and wire those neurons together was because we couldn't survive otherwise. If you were sitting around going, oh, look, everything's so beautiful and nice and I love the flowers and it's a sunny day, you weren't going to see the lion stalking.
Right.
But if you were looking for what's wrong, what's out of place, you're scanning the perimeter, you're on edge, you're kind of in a little state or a lot of state of hyper arousal, then you're going to see the lion. And what our role and goal as we need to keep evolving, right? We need to keep evolving, and we can train our brain to calm that negativity bias and wire together neurons that are associated with our essential goodness, with our kindness, with our altruism. But it just takes practice. And the default definitely is to look for what's wrong, because that's what keeps us safe.
Right. So another concept that you talk about a lot in the book is, and I feel like this is sort of the essence of the book, is desire.
It is the essence of the book.
Yeah. And the one sentence that that really stood out for me was that desire is a one-word feminist manifesto.
I love that sentence too.
I know. I'm like, I think I'm going to put that on my Instagram feed. I hope if it's okay with you.
Totally okay.
I will obviously give you a byline. But yeah, can you talk a little bit more about how desire sort of is related to feminism in your mind?
Sure. Well, to know what we want, even if we can't have it, to know what we want is to believe we are allowed to know what we want. And it's to believe that my desires matter and that I matter and that I am a sovereign being. And that seems to me like feminism 101. Mm-hmm. And pretty uncomplicated when I state it that way. But if we really start to think about it, it's the rare woman that I meet who knows what she wants. Mm. And if she does know it, and I think that's become more common, I think about my daughter, she's about to turn 26. I think she knows more what she wants, but it's still often very difficult for her to state it. It's still very difficult for her, for example, to speak up at work. She works at Seattle Children's Hospital. It's difficult for her to speak up, you know, with a difficult situation with her roommate when they get into things. And not all of this is desire or feminism, but I think a lot, when we look at the history of desire in women in the Western world and definitely other parts of the world as well, we don't see like, oh, yes, yes, women, desire what you want, right? I mean, we just have to look at the Bible and there was Eve getting ahead of herself. Yeah. So desire feels very forbidden. It feels very confusing. It feels very frustrating. And yet I think there's the possibility for such energy and liberation in there when we can allow ourselves to know it and feel it. And it's also deeply spiritual because at its core, desire is unfillable. Right? There's always a tinge of longing to whatever we desire because everything about life is passing. If everything is ephemeral, we may have a desire that's filled for a moment to have that perfect honey crisp apple and it hasn't been over engineered and it's really cold and oh, we have it with some sharp cheddar cheese and oh my God, that was incredible. But then the apple is gone. We've eaten it. Not to push the Eve metaphor too far there.
That's a good one though.
Yeah. So there's something about really allowing ourselves to desire that's both very empowering and exhilarating and energizing, but it's also perplexing and frustrating and ends up with this feeling of really touching the tender ephemeralness of our lives.
Yeah. And being able to sort of stay in touch with it as it changes.
Ah, it's huge. It's so huge. It's so hard. It's so fascinating though. And when I can do it, I am just full of wonder and awe of just being here. And when I can't, oh my God, I'm just like, I'm a little itchy child.
Yeah. The wonder that you talk about too is very interesting in the book. I was telling my husband because that was so funny. We went on a bike ride yesterday and he quoted those dogs from Up.
Oh, yes. Ball.
Yeah, ball, squirrel, squirrel. Oh my God, I was just reading. The author quoted those dogs too. It was funny. But yeah, I love that idea of like allowing yourself to do that sometimes.
I feel like wonder is one of the ways we can open the door to desire. And it's one of the ways that we can begin to sort of get a little bit of, I say in the book, ease in to bothering again, because wonder is always available to us. And when we stop knowing and start wondering, it's this sort of questioning part of our brain gets woken up, our senses get woken up. Wonder is a playful way to ease into bothering again that doesn't have to mean anything or be attached to anything.
Right. And so then after, you talked about wonder leading to desire and then how it's so difficult to feel like we deserve our desires. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like this common struggle. I know a lot of people who struggle with this, like that we don't feel we're good enough to have that, what we desire, or that we deserve it for whatever reason. I mean, I know I grew up with, my parents were great. I had everything I want it for, but there was this sort of underlying thing that like, you know, don't think you're too special, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Don't be a tall poppy.
Yeah. Like, who do you think you are? Yeah. It's, you know, not, you know, my parents were supportive in most ways, but that was sort of an underlying thing. And that really, you know, has affected my trajectory, I believe. And I don't know, I wonder if that is a generational thing. I don't know if you're a Gen Xer or...
I'm 57, so I think I'm the last year of the baby boomers, but it depends who you ask.
You're sort of on the cusp, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, reading the book, I felt like a Gen X vibe sort of, but
cool.
I don't know how you identify, but I feel like our anyway, my generation, that Gen Xers are sort of always like too cool to bother. Like we don't want to look like we care too much.
Because yeah.
It would be really embarrassing.
It can be embarrassing because you reveal yourself. It's vulnerable. You might not get it. You might be disappointed. There's so much at stake when we bother, right? But part of the message of the book and part of the message of this interview is actually there's nothing at stake. Because all that's at stake is your identity, your wishes, how you wish to appear to other people, what other people's standards are. And I feel like when we really enter deeply into knowing and befriending and being curious about desire as a life force, and when we realize that our life purpose, maybe it's not to do anything or be anything, but it's how alive can we be? How myself can I be? And honestly, if we decide that's our life purpose, how the heck can we screw it up? Right? Yeah. If I'm supposed to be here as much as I'm, as fully as I can, and be myself as fully as I can, and I don't mean that in a take me or leave me, or I get to tell you what, it, you know, I don't mean that in a 1960s, you know, encounter sort of way. I just mean, you know, I mean in a respectful, well-integrated way. Yeah. Like, how can I fail at that? How can it matter really deeply in more than a passing way if someone listening to this thinks I'm a total flake or, you know, ass or doesn't like my ideas?
Yeah, it's scary though at the same time, right?
Well, it is scary, but I think the more I practice it is, again, not that I don't forget it and want my book to be a bestseller and, you know, Oprah to call and say, you're my new best friend and all that. but when that passes through, it's more like a passing cloud. Like I'm sitting here looking at the Colorado sky and lots and lots of clouds are coming in because we're supposed to get a snowstorm, I think, tomorrow. And right now it's like 75 outside. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, if I can let those be like the clouds, which can be really scary or really big or really beautiful, but they're moving. They're not staying here.
Yeah.
There's more of an opportunity to keep finding my experience and what I value. And then it becomes easier to be my goofy, flawed self.
Right. And actually, when you think about it, it's a little bit scarier to not be yourself, because then what are you losing or what are you missing out on?
I cannot agree with you more. And when I look back at the times that I stayed so stuck in whatever my version of why bother was, and mine wasn't so much that I was afraid that someone was going to make fun of me, or I think it was more that I wouldn't be successful. That was usually my story over and over again. But when I look back at those times, my regrets are not my success, my lack of success or my success. That's not what I remember. What I remember is the times that I didn't care for myself, that I didn't allow myself to be myself, or that I kept thinking I needed to fix something, or that I needed to do something. And if I could just do that thing right, whether it was write that book or teach that class or give that keynote, then I would finally like click in some way or be good enough or be anointed. That's what I regret.
And it seems like you've sort of crossed a bridge to the other side in that department.
Most of the time, I do occasionally have to remind myself, you know, especially in this time of promoting something, because I'm emailing a lot of people, I'm making a lot of asks. Sometimes they're people I know, sometimes they're people I'm not. I'm getting a lot of no's, I'm getting a lot of silence. Not taking that personally and not having that sort of throw me back into, oh my God, what if I could just be this? Let me just try, you know, kind of, I don't want to call it fake, but it's like a real effort. And that efforting to me is a real clear sign that I'm getting off center.
Right.
And I don't mean I'm not working hard. Working hard and efforting are two different things.
Right. What's the difference?
Well, for me, when I'm efforting, it's somewhere in there is the idea that whatever I have to offer or do isn't good enough.
Right.
And when I'm working hard, it's like, hey, here's a really cool idea. Okay, cool. That feels really good. Okay, let's go out and do that. Okay, nobody likes it. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so another, I might be going a little out of order.
It's fine.
Where the things fell in the book, but I remember anger being a strong theme in the book as well that you talked about. And that's something that a lot of women struggle with, sort of owning their anger and being feeling okay with being angry about some injustice or, you know, so I, oh, and this line I loved, I wrote this line down as well. You wrote, "Is there a disowned fury it might take time to claim as starter fluid for your bothering?"
Yeah,
oh my God, that's amazing.
I do think
awesome.
Yeah, I do think that anger and fury are so much closer to the surface now. The Me Too movement brought what we've, so many of us have, if not experienced directly, indirectly, in the water, so to speak. And it was like lancing a wound. And that I think that just keeps coming up in waves in our culture in the last decade, you know, starting with Occupy Wall Street and, you know, Elizabeth Warren's been a great voice for our anger. And how do we skillfully use it? And really the question I want people to ask when reading the book is not being able to metabolize, face, give voice to my anger, my rage, is that what's causing my despair?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it, for me, it brought up, I used to be a tech journalist at a tech publication, actually, and I wrote about science. And it was a very male dominated place. And
I bet.
You know, I always felt, but I was really young too. So I always felt like, oh God, am I doing this right? I don't think I'm doing this right. I don't know what I'm doing. Like everyone thinks I'm fucking up all the time. Like I just was always in that place. And
sure. Oh my God, I've been there too.
Yeah. And so I reconnected and this was, oh God, maybe more than 15 years ago, but I just reconnected with someone who I used to work with there. And we had budget meetings every morning where we talk about like our story ideas and everybody would sort of get in on whether it was a good idea, whether it had been done before, whether we should, you know, cover it or whatever. And the woman who I recently reconnected with, she was like, by the way, like we hadn't talked in a dozen years. She said, by the way, I just want to let you know, I think that those guys were assholes to you when I won't mention the publication, but but I think those guys were assholes to you back then. And I was like, really? And she was like, yeah, I used to walk out of those meetings thinking, God, why are they like that to her or something like that? And I cannot tell you the weight that lifted off of me. I was like, oh my God, it wasn't just me thinking that like something was going on, you know, and it was, it did cause this like anger that I was tamping down.
Sure.
And you know, I'm like, I'm doing other things now and it's different, but it just was like, oh, that anger was justified and it was okay. You know,
it is. And I think that's an essential piece of women's anger that is so hard for some of us. It's justified because I feel it. Mm-hmm. Does that mean I need to go yell at somebody? Does that mean I need to go burn a house down? Maybe not,
right.
But it's justified because I feel it. And that's been a really interesting thing for my husband and I, because he's very, very afraid of someone being angry at him, especially me, because of his childhood.
Right.
Like it just freaks him out. And so a big thing for me in our 12 years together has been to be like, I get to be angry. I'm angry. And then I realized just a few months ago, oh yeah, my anger is justified in that, not justified in any larger story, but justified because I'm feeling it. But I don't actually have to share it with him because it frightens him. I can go away and be angry. I can go in the basement and, you know, dance around, or I can go for a walk, or I can, you know, I can journal about it. I can totally feel it, own it, and then understand it. But I don't have to actually in that moment, you know, say, I am so angry at you, because for him, it's really hard. And that doesn't mean there won't be times when I do feel, after I've processed a little bit, that I do need to go back and in a calmer way say, you know, I'm really angry and that wasn't okay with what you just did. In fact, I just did that a couple of days ago.
Interesting.
But that lashing out, I don't know if that's useful or makes sense, but no, it was a really important distinction. I think,
Yeah, no, sorry. I've actually, that's very useful for me personally. Yes, I do.
Good.
My husband, I think, also lives in terror of my anger. So, that's very helpful, because if you're not denied, if you process it first and then, you know, kind of calm down a little bit and then express what you were angry about, it's much easier to come. I mean, the person's going to listen to you. They're going to hear you rather than if you're lashing out.
Yeah. And for me, I think what I used to do was either lash out or just be like, and feel really good about it. And he would feel awful. Or I would think in the early days that we were together, I would totally freeze because I'd be like, oh, no, you're not allowed to be angry. You're not allowed to be angry. And I went from my first marriage with a husband who probably raised his voice to me 3 times in 18 years.
Wow.
Someone who could not, he did not know how to be angry, still doesn't know how to be angry. So, you know, this is all, I think, a frontier for all of us. But your story about work, I just want to go back and say, I think that is the power of gaslighting, right? Mm. If we, when we are gaslighting ourselves or someone else is gaslighting us, how incredibly confusing it is and how long it can stay with us.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I definitely thought it was all me, you know?
Yeah, it's all me. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
I mean, how many women have been silenced or gone in another direction or given up because of that?
Yeah. And I did. I mean, not that I think it was a bad thing, but I ended up leaving. And, you know, I was thinking about in the book, you talked about settling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I left and I went and, you know, I just did nothing for a little while. And then I trained to become a Pilates instructor. I did something like in my body, I did something completely different. And I'm glad I did all that, but I did. I was like, I'm out of here. Like, this is mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. anymore. But it felt good to do something in my body after that experience.
I bet.
Yeah. And so another thing that stood out for me is you talk about in the book, this is another quote. I just pulled out so many quotes because there were so many good ones. But this one was, even mindfulness can become a way to torment yourself, to be in increasingly more productive yet continuously chill. And I feel like this is something that I see on social media all the time right now. It's like, mm-hmm. you're supposed to hustle as much as you possibly can, but you're supposed to be totally effortless about it. It's so easy. You know, you have 18 hustles, but they're all just like coming to you with no effort.
And if they don't come to you with no effort, you would not get ruffled about it.
Right. Like,
yeah. Mindfulness has really been, to some degree, I think it's hopefully starting to change, but it's been co-opted, right?
Yeah.
Instead of a way to have more kindness towards yourself and more stability and more of ability to witness and not be caught up and hijacked by your emotions, mindfulness has become a productivity hack.
Mm-hmm.
For some people in some contexts. And then it becomes so oppressive. And I actually, right before the pandemic full on, so it was our last, it was just when we were all realizing we should probably socially isolate, but nobody had announced that yet. Nobody was talking about it, but we were, this group of friends and I were all kind of piecing it together. Like, why would a group of 500 be okay? Like a group of 500 but not a group bigger than 500. That makes no sense. And we were all out to dinner and we realized this is probably the last time we're all going to be to dinner for quite a while. And anyway, we were there and I realized at that dinner that I was feeling guilty about being stressed about promoting the book. And I think that's exactly that same thing. Like, I'm supposed to be so chill and so evolved that I don't get stressed. So I was putting guilt on top of the stress.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And I was able to talk to my girlfriend who's sitting next to me at this dinner. And she's just one of the most special people in the world. She's in the book, Jabe.
Oh, yeah.
And she's really, we say Jabe's our spirit
animal. Is that the running coach? Your running coach?
Yes, she's my running coach, right? Yeah. Who runs as fast as I walk, by the way. She's the slowest runner on the face of the planet.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
I'm not kidding, but she's gotten so many people to run. And she just looked at me with such tenderness and love and said, we love you no matter what happens with the book.
Aww. That's
and I think that's what, yeah, isn't it? And it's what we need to learn to do to ourselves.
There, I don't know if you know the author Todd Parr, children's books.
I don't.
Well, he might be, your daughter's older, so I don't know if he's newer, but he's adopted and he writes about being adopted. But one of his books is called I Love You When. I think it's called I Love You When. And the whole book is like, I love you when you set the table. I love you when you spill the water. I love you when you're clean after a bath. I love you when your diaper is dirty. Like, it's like teaching. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me such an important lesson for, you know, for a child, like, you know, everything can go wrong. We're still going to love you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when my my first husband, this is before we were married, and his best friend told me this story. He was in college the first year. He was still living at home, and he got a DUI. And his dad came and got him out of jail, and he walked in the door, and the first thing his mom said was, "Come here and give me a hug."
Aww.
You know, and I'm just like, yeah, that's the unconditional love that we want from our parents and we didn't all get. Maybe they gave it to us in some ways, but couldn't in others, because that's just the way it is to be human. But we can learn to give it to ourselves. And it's such an important part of going through the hard times and the blah times and the lost times in life, which a lot of us are going to be going through because of this pandemic, and finding our way through the other side, finding what we want to bother about, how we want to bother, how we want to care going forward.
Yeah. And that's I just have like a couple more questions. And one of them was actually about, is it your running coach's name? Is it Jabe?
Exactly. Yeah. Jabe.
Yeah. And I thought your interaction that you described with her was really interesting, because, and it reminded me back to the beginning of the book when you called your friend about your screenplay and you wanted to like quit writing for a while. You didn't really get a supportive reaction or the reaction you might have hoped to get from her. And so I felt like the lesson in there is that you can't rely on other people to like give you what you need for yourself. But then when you had this interaction with Jabe and she said, "You're a natural runner," and you were like, "Really?" You know, and that was a really important interaction for you there. And I don't know if you have any tips on how to discern between, you know, a reaction or something that you're getting from someone that is not helpful, productive, useful, and one that you should really take to heart. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a great question. Boy, I tell you, sometimes I feel like I have been the lousiest person looking for and finding people to be those supportive, honest, loving mirrors. I got really lucky moving in my neighborhood and meeting Jabe. I think maybe the thing that I try to look for now is, does it feel good in my body? You know, you mentioned, you know, becoming a Pilates instructor, doing something in our bodies. Does it feel good in my body? And then how much, I think the other thing I'm always having to learn is, how much authority am I giving them?
Mm.
I think the thing about Jabe and running was so never in my wheelhouse, never anything I was interested in. I made fun of people who ran. I mean, I really did. And to stumble upon this thing that has become so joyful and interesting and important for me, and interestingly for my husband, is, it was not something I was looking for. So maybe that was part of what made it so magical, in addition to that she's an incredible person. And incredibly good at seeing people, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the thing that I now wonder about for myself is, how much authority am I giving them? And what am I looking for? Why am I going to them, you know? Because my default is to go looking for someone to tell me I'm good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to kind of play against that. And then I try to think about, how does my energy feel? You know, some people they just make you feel more energetic or on top of the world, or they challenge you in a way that feels really nourishing. So trying to pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's really good advice, I think. Yeah. And so when I read your bio, I was like, oh my God, she was on Oprah.
Yeah.
So, and I don't want to tell the Oprah story, and I'm not asking you to tell the Oprah story because I want people to buy your book and read the Oprah story. But I have to admit, I was like reading the book in anticipation of the scene. I was like, okay, she has to tell us about it. What was it like? Did you like start, like, did your aura change color when you came? But I thought it was very interesting that, you know, it didn't go exactly the way you planned. And I'm not going to tell the story, but sort of part of the lesson learned was that Oprah could not give you this thing that you thought you were going to get from her. Right. Mm-hmm. And you said, you know, I think it was something like, our future lies more in our choices and our actions. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so important, because I know I do this. Like, I'm always looking into the future. Like, well, when I finally get, you know, like a million page views on my website, or when I finally do this. But being able to sit with what needs to be done, that what you need to do yourself to get there, is so important, rather than sort of just like looking to someone else or this magic bullet or whatever. Does that, any of that make sense, what I just said?
I mean, it totally makes sense. I mean, it goes back to desire is a one-word feminist manifesto. Mm-hmm. I desire you desire the website and the podcast to be successful, to be profitable, to take care of you. That's a genuine desire. You may or may not get it. It's never going to unfold the way we imagine, because that's just not how life works. But that genuine desire becomes something that you can take action on. Mm. And a genuine desire that turns into nothing but wishes and wishing for someone else to do it for us is incredibly demeaning and demoralizing. And I know, because I've done it many, many times, including with Oprah. Mm. And I have to keep relearning it over and over again. I get into these fantasies about who's going to, you know, do something for the book, and then it's all just going to unfold from there. And it's okay to have those. I mean, that's what our minds do. They're very innocent. Our thoughts are very innocent. But it becomes very different when we're waiting for our life to have value, or even our life to begin, or to begin again after a loss or a grief or something ending or being taken from us, which is going to happen during this pandemic with businesses changing and closing and such. Are we going to lose this life that's going to unfold now because we didn't get that wish, or because we can't have what we had before?
Yeah.
That's the question I keep asking myself. I mean, this sounds so silly, but here we go. I don't want to be unhappy because my book doesn't do well. That seems to me so horrible. And so another way I might flip it is, sometimes I say to myself, you're allowed to be so happy and delighted on this day, even while a pandemic is going on, even while your book is, you don't know what it's going to do. You're allowed to enjoy this moment this morning with my husband cuddling, right? You're allowed to totally enjoy this. You don't have to earn it. You don't have to wait.
Yeah. I've actually enjoyed a lot of the, you know, having to be at home and, you know, reconnecting with my family. But then I've immediately felt guilty about it because of all the suffering, you know, that's going on and everything causing us to be at home. But it's a good reminder that you can, two things can exist at the same time.
Yeah, there's a wonderful poem by Jack Gilbert. A Brief for the Defense of Heaven. And you can all look it up, or you can give a link to it. I'm sure it's online somewhere. And it's about, we need to risk delight. You know, if we're not, then everyone else's suffering sort of becomes, we're like taking away their suffering by saying, I'm not allowed to be happy. I'm not allowed to risk delight.
Right. And, you know, when you're talking about, you know, sort of waiting for your life to begin, there's a sort of a flip side to that where there's this, I feel like there's this why bother that happens a lot of times when women are, you know, around 50 years old, you know, around midlife, when you, you know, your kids are out of school, your parents are getting older, you may have, you know, abandoned your career because to, you know, to raise kids, and now they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this book would be very useful for someone in that situation. I don't know if that may be even a lot of the women you were sort of writing to.
Yeah, I had a couple different women, real women in mind. And one woman was exactly that person who woke up in her late 50s and went, I've lived my entire life for everyone else. I've done everything I was supposed to do. And I don't have any idea who I am or what I want. And so that was somebody, a real person I know. So I wrote the book to her. I wrote the book also for someone who I know who has been really successful and sort of was like, okay. And the success, you know, not didn't come to an end, but it as a sort of, it's, she's not sure she wants, like, do I have it in me to keep doing this? Do I want to do a something else like this? Do I want to start another company? You know, these are all very genuine questions. And I don't think they necessarily have an age attached to them. I think there are questions that sometimes come to us at different times for different reasons. And then another person I had in mind was just someone who was profoundly burned out from doing so much and kind of running away from themselves for a long time.
Mm, yeah. Well, I enjoyed the book so much.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, thank you.
I really loved it. And I could interview you like literally for another 3 hours. I do have two more quick questions that are kind of silly, but I'd like to ask you them anyway.
Yes.
So I'm very interested in style and personal style and fashion. And you're wearing this outfit on your website and you're wearing these like tiger stripe booties. And I am so obsessed with your outfit in that picture. So I'm curious if you would mind talking about that outfit.
Well, I decided those boots, they have like two different animal prints, right? One in the front and one in the back. And I decided, like, animal prints are so in, yeah. you have to exaggerate them. Yeah. So I decided those boots were just, like, hysterical. They were, like, not just one animal print, but two animal prints. But my favorite thing was when I bought them, I took a picture of them on Instagram, and someone actually said, those aren't real, are they? And I'm like, no, I don't think anyone ever made shoes out of those two animals. I hope no one ever made shoes out of those two animals. Yeah, so that was the story behind those. I was like, oh, animal print, so in. Let's go all the way in on animal print.
Yeah. Are you interested in style and personal style in general?
You know, not until I got older. And I think that's partly been, I've worked at home from almost my whole life. Mm-hmm. So I would need to look good when I would give a keynote, but I lead a lot of retreats. And so very casual, you know, you want to be put together, but you definitely aren't being super fashionable. But I found that aging, there's something about aging that you feel like, I really want to be put together when I go out. Mm-hmm. It's something about that has been more curious for me. So I have been buying more clothes. I've gotten really into neck scarves because they cover my neck, which is just the best. Those little tiny, you know, they get it, Madewell always has a bunch of them. So I am into, although you would never know it right now because I'm sitting here in the same pair of sweatpants that I have worn. They are clean. I just washed them. But I've been wearing them a lot.
Yeah, I bought a new sweatsuit specifically for this whole situation.
Nice.
I have to somehow like feel some joy in what I'm putting on.
I know.
But okay, and the last thing is you have this amazing gray streak in your hair.
It's
amazing. And I'm just curious if it's if it's natural, if you've ever considered like, you know, coloring it, or have you always just left it natural?
Yeah, it started about 10 years ago or so, and I stopped. I'm not somebody who can sit still easily. I mean, I'm a longtime meditator, but I'm also very kinesthetic and I have a lot of energy. And so my hairdresser, when I moved here, it started, and then I would get really frustrated because I had to go get my hair colored more often. Right. And I hate that. I hate the time it takes. I hate sitting still. So we started to let it grow out. And then when I moved here, my new hairdresser, I moved to Colorado from near the Seattle area. Mm-hmm. And my new hairdresser was like, let's really let it grow out and let your hair grow out too. But sometimes she puts a little bit of bleach in it because sometimes she says it gets too ashy looking. Every other time she puts some bleach in. And now, of course, I haven't had my hair colored in I don't know how many months because I was due for a hair coloring and then everything shut down. So I'm finding out how gray is the rest of my hair because my hairdresser has said, oh no, the rest of that, it's only that stripe. And I'm like, really? Are you sure? So we'll find out. Stay tuned.
Boat. I was like due for a haircut and a color. And now I'm going to be way overdue, but you know, it's good to discover what's really going on there.
I know. It's very fascinating. I'm like, damn, if only I had gone like 4 days earlier than when I was scheduled.
Yes. Well, like I said, I could talk to you all afternoon, but I know you have an important appointment to go give blood.
I'm going to go give some blood.
I want to respect your time. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. I really enjoyed your book. And if you are, all listeners out there should look for her book, Why Bother? And it's going to come out on April 21st.
It is.
Okay. And people can buy it on Amazon or what are the...
They can buy it anywhere the books are sold. And if you want some gifties for buying it, you can go to jenniferloudon.com/why-bother.
Nice.
Why-bother. And then we have all kinds of things we're giving you for buying a book, because that's what you do these days. Give people a lot of stuff, including a chance to win one of my retreats this summer.
Ooh, so. Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much again. Enjoyed your book so much. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you the best with the launch and the rest of this shelter-in-place situation.
No, thank you so much. You were a fantastic interviewer. I enjoyed this conversation. It really, really pumped up my mood. So I'm sure my blood will flow much more easily for the donation.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that. Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to The Mean Podcast. Please check out the online magazine at www.meanmagazine.com. And get in touch if you or someone you know should be featured in the magazine or on the podcast. Mm-hmm.